Institute. I'm Nance Haxton, and this is A Matter of Crime. Today's episode features an expert panel on promoting child safety and preventing child sexual abuse and exploitation. It was recorded as part of the 2019 conference of the Australian and New Zealand Association of the Treatment of Sexual Abuse, hosted by Griffith University.
Good evening. My name is Danielle Harris. I'm the Deputy Director of Research at the Griffith Youth Forensic Service and a Senior Lecturer in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. I'm also a proud Brisbane local and the Chair of this year's biennial ANZATSA Conference, and I'd like to welcome you this evening. So, children should be seen and not heard, not in front of the kids. Children should speak only when spoken to. Sound familiar? Oh, is it just my mum that raised me? It's going to be awkward because she's right there. So 20 years of research in this field has taught me that we can do better than that. We can do better than children should be seen and not heard. Language matters and communication is key, and our efforts for child protection should focus on prevention, education, awareness raising, and early intervention. The conference theme this year is Valuing All Voices. Tonight, we're here to learn how to raise our kids to raise their voices. What to say, how to say it, when to and how to speak up, how to talk so our kids will listen, but also how to listen so our kids will talk. What questions to ask and how to ask them. Once they've found a voice, what do they do with it? How do they negotiate that voice in the increasingly complex online environment? To help us navigate these sensitive and difficult terrain, I'm thrilled to introduce our host tonight, who will then introduce the panel. Please join me in welcoming Jewel Walkley Award-winning journalist Nance Haxton, aka The Wandering Journo, freelance podcaster and investigative journalist for Griffith University and the ABC. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Danielle, and thanks also to the Australian and New Zealand Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abuse for hosting this information evening and giving the opportunity for this hour-long Q&A panel discussion on such an important topic, raise your kids to raise their voice. So thanks also to this most impressive panel of speakers, who I'll introduce in a moment. All our panel have been working for a number of years in various areas of child protection, and tonight we'll bring together all of their unique experiences and professional expertise. A lot about this issue is really difficult to talk about. A lot of people will have questions tonight. It's every parent's worst nightmare, really. So let's make a space where we can have that conversation and ask those questions in a way that's respectful, really, of the fact that statistically, in this room of 100 people, there are probably 35 survivors in this room right now. Almost all of you will know someone who's been sexually abused. If we know this phenomenon is so far-reaching, then all of us have a role in its prevention. So tonight, we will hear from each speaker in turn before going to the next speaker. Have a moment to summarise at the end. Firstly, we have Detective Inspector John Rouse, who served in the Queensland Police Force for more than 35 years. Just over two decades ago, John started investigating crimes against children, and in 2001 began working at Task Force Argos, where he implemented Australia's first operation to proactively target internet child sex offenders. Since then, he's overseen multiple national and international investigations into child exploitation criminal networks and has delivered training to law enforcement officers in Australia and around the world. Thank you for joining us, John.
Welcome.
Next, we have Professor Martine Powell, who's the founding director of the Centre for Investigative Interviewing, a division of the Griffith Criminology Institute. Over the past two decades, Martine has become the go-to person for advice on interviewing vulnerable witnesses. Since 2008, Martine has become known for her work radically improving training practices that are now attracting influence or interest from around the world. And finally, we have Carol Ronkin, the Director of Research of Bravehearts. Carol worked as a researcher and an associate lecturer at Griffith University in the Criminology School before joining Bravehearts in early 2003. Carol's passion is to ensure that Bravehearts is at the forefront of preventing, responding to, and ultimately reducing the incidence of child sexual assault in the community. Carol co-authored a book, The Bravehearts Toolbox, for practitioners working with child sexual assault, We'll hopefully hear more about that later. And in 2011, she received an award from the Queensland Police Service Child Protection and Investigation Unit for her contribution to child protection. Can we welcome our panel? Thank you so much for joining us. Firstly, John, I'd like to congratulate you for being chosen as Queenslander of the Year for 2019 for your work in this most difficult and traumatic area of child exploitation. That was a wonderful honour to receive.
Yeah, if I could hide under the table, I would, but thank you. Yeah.
You've been working in this particular field for over 15 years, as we said. I'm sure I'm not the only one here who'd really like to thank you personally, basically, for the work you've undertaken for the greater good in that time. But what have you seen change in those years, in that 15 years, when you're investigating child sexual abuse?
Well, when we started, we were dealing with 14-4 fax modems, VGA monitors, Voodoo 2 video cards. A couple of meg of RAM was just enormous. You had the capacity, in terms of as a communication platform back then, we were dealing with realistically just news groups and internet relay chat, two platforms to talk. And then that evolved into MSN Messenger and, then we got dial-up, we're now, fibre to building. Kids are now fully mobile with the phones. So the environment has changed in a way that I just almost can't explain to you, other than to give you maybe some statistics that let you know what we're dealing with now. And I could have put these in slides, but I just wrote down the figures for you. So if you're not aware, Interpol hosts a database in Lyon in France called ICSA, International Child Sexual Exploitation Database. And progressively, the 190 plus member countries are coming online with ICSA. The purpose of ICSA is to have a central repository for the images of children that are sexually abused, that we come across in our investigations and that are rescued through our operations. In 2002, that database had 138 kids on it. As of April this year, we have 19,481 children on it. And that's scratching the surface of the issue. So some things that have caused that evolution have been law enforcement awareness. We now, if you haven't heard of Jeffrey Robert Dobbs, Jeffrey Robert Dobbs was arrested by Argos in around about the early 2000s. And of the 67 victims that we identified that he sexually abused, a lot of those are now on the ICSA database. So we became aware of ICSA. So we are now contributing to the Interpol database, and that helps the rest of the world not re-victimise children. It cuts down in duplication of effort. So LEA awareness capability, that training that I've been involved in is about raising capability, changing policy, changing legislation, criminalising. This wasn't even a criminal offence in Queensland until 2003. Image of a child being raped was under the Classification of Computer Games and Images Act. And we had to get a state government censor to give us a certificate saying it was illegal. That's evolution. But a lot of countries don't criminalize, so we're working on that. Industry, so companies like NetClean have produced technology that we now use to manage the database. Our database in Brisbane at our office is the largest in the Southern Hemisphere, over 80 million unique images and videos of children. We couldn't do that without industry stepping in to start giving us tools to do our job more efficiently. And one of the most significant things that kind of leads me into the threat that we're facing. So in 2009, Microsoft developed a tool called PhotoDNA, PDNA. What that enables us to do is to map pixels on an image. The two ways that we can track an image on the internet is attach set. So every image has a unique hexadecimal string, and I won't talk too geeky. If you're falling asleep, I know I need to deviate, but we can break a photograph down into a hexadecimal string that is unique to that image. The only way that will change is if the image is cropped or you change the shading of it in some way, shape, or form. To defeat that, PDNA maps pixels. So you can turn the image on its head, change the color, it's still going to say that's the same image. So in collaboration with Microsoft, we've shared our data, not files, but PDNA signatures with industry. Now, what does that mean? Okay, so that means that Facebook, for example, Facebook Messenger, when people are talking on Messenger, PDNA is analyzing what you're sharing. Now, that's not an intrusion on your privacy, that's picking up illegal material. So, cyber tips. Facebook reports that to the National Center for Missing Children in Washington, D.C., who run a cyber tip program. They collate it, the IP, the username, the platform they're on, and then they send cyber tips globally to law enforcement agencies. And I've been working with NCMEC for 19 years now. Some stats on cyber tips that will tell you, you know, I told you about the growth in the ICSA database, okay? In 2014, NCMEC distributed 1.1 million cyber tips globally. Sounds like a lot. And that, in 2014, PDNA was provided to industry. Okay, 2009 PDNA, 2014, we have 1.1 million cyber tips. The things that happened around 2014, think about technology, think about the apps that kids started to use, Kik, Snapchat, Instagram, all of these started coming online. So, hang on to your hat. So 2018, 18.4 million cyber tips have gone out. Now that's 18.4 million tips to law enforcement about illegal activity online, whether it's an image going into Dropbox or going across Facebook Messenger or on any of the other program platforms that are sharing their information. So 99% of that 18.4 million files comes from industry that are reporting this. That should give you, that's just one area that we work in. We proactively do a lot of other stuff, but we are responding to those cyber tips. An example of what a cyber tip is. We last year, in 2017, we arrested a university professor in Queensland who had progressively groomed 157 children globally, convincing them that he was Justin Bieber. And he made those children do things that I really could never show you, and in the sanctity of their own homes. So what we're seeing now, the biggest challenge for law enforcement that I'll put out to you, because we've got mums and dads, I guess, here that have come to hear about our view, the biggest single threat that we're facing right now, 70% of the material that Argos now analyzes is self-produced. That's your child producing child exploitation material, 70%. We have a classic example, which is quite horrendous to sit through and watch, is about a 12-year-old girl, she's sitting in her bedroom, and you, as the police officer, have offender's view, because he's captured the engagement with his child. And she's sitting there with tears streaming down her face in her bedroom, responding to each question that he types in as yes master, no master. Ultimately, he makes her do things with a hairbrush, and this is all captured on video, and it's in our possession. At the end of the engagement, he convinces her that he won't distribute the video because she's been a good slave in the sanctity of your home. So what do you think mum and dad thought when she came out to join the dinner table that night, broke up with a boyfriend, maybe? Or had a run-in with a friend, or there'd been some cyberbullying incident. No, she has just been sexually exploited to a degree that you just could not even possibly imagine. So that, for us at the moment, is the biggest thing on my radar. Is on one hand, I've got a team, the best in the world, in my opinion, of victim identification experts that we've brought in, where we are dealing with horrendous sexual abuse of children that's been captured by offenders. And honestly, that's where I should be putting the thin blue line, but we are increasingly now having to respond to little girls like this who do not have the cognitive ability to deal with what's going on, and ultimately we see suicide from that because they don't know what to do. Google Amanda Todd when you go home. Get onto YouTube and have a look at her suicide note. Children don't have the ability, and I'll rely on other experts to give their opinion on that, but this is a crisis at the moment for us as a society. And we have a pretty difficult job. I would never say that we don't, but we step up to the mark and do our best to try to stop the sexual exploitation of children. But stopping children sexually exploit themselves is another sphere that the mobile app companies and industry have created. Which leads to probably my final closing comment, I guess, before I give you guys some latitude, is that those cyber tips are important. Okay, that's intelligence that leads us to stop the sexual abuse of children. So Mark Zuckerberg, in his infinite wisdom in January, announced that they will be encrypting Facebook Messenger for reasons of privacy. So that means that we don't get PDNA run across those files. Skype is the platform that that little girl was exploited on. We took Microsoft, who owned Skype, to task over this, and on the basis of privacy, they will not run artificial intelligence algorithms, which they have, across their platform out of privacy concerns. Yet their platforms are being used for this kind of issue. So on that uplifting note...
what do you advise for the parents and aunties and friends, the members of the community who are here, as how do we monitor our children's online use now that it's so mobile, such a risk?
Well, the first thing we would say is educate yourself. So if you've provided your child with that for the reason of keeping in touch with your child, which is a legitimate thing to do, have a look at the apps they've installed on the mobile phone. If it's Snap, just about every application has communication ability, okay? If you don't know how that's used, if you don't know how Snapchat's used, if you don't know how Instagram or what a Finstagram account is, you better start educating yourself because your children are running rings around you. If you see two calculators on your child's phone, one's not a calculator, okay? One's a photo locker. That's where they keep a lot of the images that they're not sharing, okay? So rule one, educate yourself in how these applications are being used. Get your child to sit down with you and open the app up and have a look at their 97,000 friends that they've got on Snapchat and have a conversation about what that means about these people. That little girl from the Skype conversation probably thought she was going to be an Instagram star. So she did something on Instagram to get more likes. And you'll notice that Instagram have stopped the visibility on likes recently. Okay, that's a really positive move. But she thought that she'd be a star, she did something she shouldn't have, and that then leads to sextortion. You will do this next time or else I will put it on the internet. So for mums and dads, educate yourself. If I was a parent, I am a parent, but my daughter's 25 and over at, where is she at the moment? She just went to Comic-Con. So she's over in San Diego playing with stormtroopers and went to Star Wars World and all that sort of. She's a complete geek, not like me. But she, if she was 7 or 8 now, when she went to bed, I'd be taking that. And I'd probably be turning the Wi-Fi off. That'd be the first two things as a parent I'd be going, surrender your device. Thank you. See you in the morning. Because you don't know what they're doing at 2 a.m. in the morning, do you? Really? That's the best piece of advice I can give you. Other than that, go to the eSafety Commissioner's webpage. The one-stop shop that we send everybody to get information about the latest threats, the latest apps kids are using, and really good information about how to have that conversation with your child. Because a lot of parents, I think, in my view now, are trying to be their friends where they really should be being their parents.
How much can you tell and warn children, do you think? I know myself, I struggle with not wanting to instill the fear of even going out into the community, but how do you strike that balance between that and being aware of what can happen?
Yeah, well, and look, a lot of this is going to come down to your relationship with the child, and it's always going to be different. You know, everyone's busy, you know? Mum and dad get home, go to your homework, you just don't have the conversation because everybody now is busy. The whole family dynamic has now changed. And if you go out to dinner, I've seen families of 5 sitting at dinner all on their phone. What are you, texting each other? Or where's the conversation? So that's a big challenge for society. Like me walking down to the Queen Street Mall and not getting attacked by the zombie horde that are looking into their phones is a big enough challenge. But you need to start, I think, thinking about how you run the family dynamic at home and get conversation going again. Put the devices away when you get home. That would be a good start, and that would enable you to have the conversation about safety.
Thank you very much, John. And so, Martin, how do you advise that we raise our kids to raise their voice? Using voice really means having a language that's appropriate. I suppose that's a start, isn't it?
There's some really things resonate with what John was saying. I think the word the crisis, we are in a crisis. And one of the things you might have been thinking is the child at the dinner table. Why didn't they report what was going on? Or why weren't they asked the questions? I mean, we've just come out of a Royal Commission into Institutional Abuse of Children. Their website is full of stories of children who did show signs of abuse that were not followed up. But also I see cases where it's the opposite. A child said something and it was followed up with such rigorous confirmation-based approach that when by the time it goes to trial, you can't disentangle the child's original story from that of the interviewers. And you see a lot of expensive trials that end up... We're not... Both of these are examples of not actually hearing the voice of the child, not properly following up. Why don't people follow up when a child initially reports, either through words or behaviour? Well, I think we know that there are a number of reasons. Maybe scared of re-traumatising the child. They would rather look for evidence in other ways than to actually have the child actually relay what experiences have they had. Would it have re-traumatised the child to relay what had happened in that bedroom? I think people, it's easier to turn a blind eye, particularly for professionals. We've seen many cases of that. Maybe not confident in someone's own questioning skills at being able to elicit an account of what happened. Or maybe not sure of whether children are able to tell. And concerns about children's reliability as witnesses are still quite commonplace and alive and well. How do I know? Because I'm always asked the question from people, how reliable are children as witnesses? When, at what age can we rely on what a child says and as an accurate account? Can we trust children to give accurate accounts? Now, from where I'm sitting, after 28 years in science of children's testimony and memory, the answer to those questions is very simple. Any scientist practitioner would give the same two-word answer. It depends. It depends. The memory is due to a myriad of factors. Children, like adults, can be highly accurate and detailed when recalling events, but their accounts can, in some circumstances, be susceptible to distortion. Processes that affect adults' ability to remember are the same processes that affect children's ability to remember. The memory doesn't work in any different way. It's affected by prior knowledge, biases, expectations, how well they saw and processed what was going on, the amount of time that's passed. Now, some of these factors related to memory make us prone to error. And children can be more prone to error than adults in some circumstances, but not by virtue of their age. Age doesn't make someone incapable of providing, accurate, detailed accounts of what happened. As young as 4 years of age, if you have a verbal ability of a four-year-old, you're able to encode, store, and retrieve and give an accurate account of what happened. Research shows us that in some contexts, children are more reliable than adults. They're less suggestible. So, in the 28 years that I've been working as a teacher, a clinician, and then an academic studying children as witnesses, it's never ceased to amaze me how well even children as young as 4 are able to recall things accurately and with detail that have happened to them even many years after they occurred. So instead of thinking of children as a class of witness that's different and, should we be relying on this class, we should really focus on the comment, the answer, it depends phase, and think about the factors that affect their ability to provide accurate disclosures to us. And one of the most under-recognised factors that I want to talk about now for a few minutes, and one of the most potent, is the interview context. And I refer to a relationship between an interviewer and a child and the questions asked and the way the responses are followed up. A statement or an account or a disclosure emerges out of a relationship
between two people. And most errors that children make in their recall of events arise because of the actions or dialogue of an interviewer within that relationship and not because of a child's inferior language or memory ability. As a society, we need to empower children as valued informants, but instead, what we're doing is undermining the voice of the child as a valued witness. We do this by projecting responsibility away from the interviewer, who we know through science is one of the most critical roles in what a child says. And what we do is we have myths that propagate the myths that it's the child rather than the questioner. You know, we think we have some magical ability to tell whether a child's telling us the truth or not, which is wrong. We make up special procedures in our system, some that scientists think are kind of really crazy procedures. These truth lie tests or competency tests. In this state, for a child to give evidence, sometimes they have to undergo a psychologist has to write a report as to whether they're competent to testify. Organisations ignore the specialisation needed to learn how to ask questions, thinking it's just, well, learnt on the job. Basic skills like how to communicate well, and I should say skills in how to sleep well and eat well, they're not something humans are naturally very good at. There's some evidence-based strategies that with a bit of practice and feedback and learning about the science can help us do all these things better. Most adults, and that includes teachers, police, parents, are not naturally very good at questioning in a way that elicits accurate and elaborate accounts from children. We are actually more prone, without good training, to ask questions that are known through thousands of studies to increase error. So what is a good interview? Well, it's beyond the bounds of my little snippet of time here I've got to talk to you, but there are three main things we can do. Build strong relationships with children based on trust. Build strong rapport with children. Do that by demonstrating that you can listen and accept what they say without judgment. We need to show that we value children's role as informants and give them practice in talking to us in elaborate ways about personal events in their life. Secondly, we need to make clear to children through our instructions that different conversations have different conversational rules. I went to some media training today and I was told what to do if you ask a question that it doesn't reflect your area of expertise. Well, you say, rather than saying, oh, I don't know, you deflect it back to what I do know. And this is so we're taught how to actually engage and communicate in different contexts. Children are quite naive in that. They haven't had as much experience with it. So, you know, at a dinner party, for example, I'll be much more elaborate. I'll be more prone to making Arabic, and that's more acceptable. You know, we're about telling a story that's interesting. Very different rules of conversation than what I'm doing sitting here right now, or when I go to court, or, you know, these conversations about matters of misconduct or abuse are very serious conversations, and children need to be taught about the rules of those conversations in those settings, that it's important not to guess, it's important to say that you don't know if you don't know the response. Thirdly, we need to practice using non-leading open questions that encourage elaborate and accurate accounts of events that have happened, and children aren't provided enough opportunity, I think, in daily life and in order to do that. It's not common in English-speaking culture to really have this very elaborate way of engaging about narratives and events. It's a very, very specific directive style of conversation. The type of questions that will get the best out of children are those that are action-focused and concrete, that focus on what happened. Tell me what happened. What happened then? Tell me more about the part where. Rather than the typical English-speaking questions, who, what, when, where, how, very directive. So I ask that we all go home and practice some of these skills. We seek proper training if we're a professional. We do use questions that acknowledge the abilities of children and others around you. You make children feel valued as informants within our culture, and you enable them to accurately report what they know. And if you do this, you not only empower children to speak out in a way that will help combat abuse, but your newly learned skills will have positive consequences to improve all relationships in your life.
Thank you so much, Martin. So it's really about empowering children, and language has a part in that as well, being quite specific in language with anatomical terms as well. I've heard that that's really crucial.
I want to make the point that most language and memory development is finished by 7 years of age. this is not about children having lower memory cognitive language. Mm. This is about, there is also, being a good informant involves, it emerges from a relationship based on trust and practice in responding to the types of questions that elicit elaborate accounts.
So as well as saying your head, your nose, your shoulders, it's vagina, it's a bottom, you don't use pretend play words with these. We talk about that quite openly within that family home.
Yes.
In the right context, as you say, and teach that context as well.
And I think showing, I mean, most we're pack animals as humans. We want to be accepted, we want to be valued. And I think what people want when they're disclosing things is to be heard, understood, and not judged. And you see this in all aspects. And if we can show that in our communication, they'll be more likely to have the trust to speak out.
I wonder if there's a role in legislation too, because what you were saying about, it's also what we believe of children, isn't it? And that's reflected by legislation. If our legislation doesn't recognise that vulnerable witnesses should be heard, we're up against a pretty tough...
We've come a long way from, you know, 20 to 30 years ago when we saw children as unreliable witnesses. But there are still some practices that reinforce that children can't. And one is the competency testing, the truth and lies. Mm-hmm. These, by virtue of age, they are not a different class of witnesses. And as I said, they are, in some situations, less prone to error than adults.
Is that investigative interviewing becoming more common now, that open-ended interviewing to get this information from children?
What makes a good interview protocol, what makes a good procedure for interviewing, is a very settled area of science. We know it so well. We're tweaking little bits around the edges, but we know that open-ended, non-leading questions elicit, all roads have led to that. But an area where we have major areas of improvement is how to teach professionals to actually adopt the type of questioning required to elicit those accounts. And that's a different area of science that's involving in transfer of learning into workplaces, practice, teaching, and we have a long way to go in achieving that.
Thank you, Martine. I think that's a great point to go to Carol, and also to back up with the work that you do with Bravehearts. Carol, can you tell us, to begin with, what the organisation's trying to achieve with empowering children?
I think that, for Bravehearts, the issue has always been that, look, we know that one in five children are going to be sexually assaulted or exploited in some way before they turn 18. And, you know, that figure is just absolutely unacceptable. I think that for me, I try not to talk about preventing child sexual abuse or sort of stopping it from happening, because I know that's just unrealistic. We're never going to stop it from happening. It is always going to be in our society. But we can reduce the figures. And, you know, for Bravehearts, I think, you know, the biggest thing is dealing with the issue holistically. And we do have, you know, education programs that we take out to schools. And a big part of that is also trying to engage with parents for the children in those schools where the program is going, as well as parents more broadly, as well as teachers and professionals within the school. And I think that one of the biggest messages that we can start talking to children about personal safety and protective behaviours at very young ages. You know, we take the program, it's, I hate doing this, I sound like I'm advertising our program. There are many great programs out there, but I know about ours. So with the Ditto program, you know, we take it out to schools from prep to grade three, so very little kids. We also take a version out to childcare centres, so even younger children. And the whole premise around the program is not about making kids responsible for their own safety, because, you know, one of the things that I always like to say is not kids' responsibility to keep themselves safe. You know, that's our job as adults to keep kids safe. But, you know, just as we teach kids the road rules, you know, we can teach kids to be as safe as possible. It's just an important skill to learn. And I think that, you know, I was trying to remember the rules that we teach, because it's probably been about 10 years since I've gone to see our show. I should know. So you know, they're very basic rules. I think the first rule is that we all have the right to feel safe with people. So teaching kids about their rights to be safe. The second one, which I think sort of follows on from a bit what Danielle said in the introduction around how, you know, we talk about children being unseen and, you know, keeping them quiet and keeping them aside. The second rule is that children have the right to say no. And a lot of parents don't like that, but we do add in the end, you know, we all have the right to say no if we feel unsafe or unsure. So we're not telling kids that you can refuse to do your homework, that Ditto said you don't have to do it. But if you're feeling unsafe or unsure, that, you know, you can say no to an adult. That's a really difficult one teaching for kids. And I try when we talk to parents is that, you know, we can teach kids to have the right to say no. But the reality, and, you know, John knows this very well, that, you know, offenders will spend a lot of time grooming children, so they won't feel like they can say no. And the other thing around all of this is that between around 90 and 95% of the time, the offender is someone that the child knows, loves and trusts. And, of course, that makes it even more difficult to say no to someone. But, you know, we do need to teach kids their rights, so I think it's a really important rule. And then the third rule, which I just forgot, is nothing is so yucky that you can't tell someone about it. So, again, a lot of kids don't want to talk about this. It makes them feel really uncomfortable. So trying to teach kids that, look, no matter what's happened, you know, you can tell someone that you know. So I think that, you know, those sorts of messages are really broad. It's about their rights, and they're things that can be instilled in kids from young ages. We also know, unfortunately, though, that a lot of children don't like to disclose to their parents. And, you know, one of the things that came out of the Royal Commission was that for, you know, a large majority of offenders, it took 20, 30, 40 years before they told anybody about what happened. Sometimes some of the adult survivors that we work with tell us that they waited till their parents died because they didn't want their parents to know that this had happened to them. They didn't want their parents to feel any guilt or to feel any responsibility. So they waited till their parents had passed away. And so, you know, children often want to protect their parents. They don't want their parents to feel bad, so they often won't tell their parents. So part of the Ditto program, again, and this is actually part of all protective behaviour type programs, is getting kids to identify at least five people that they feel safe with, that they could talk to if something was happening that they felt unsure about. And I think that's a really important thing because, again, as parents and as adults, you know, we often have very busy lives, and sometimes children try to tell us things in little odd ways, and we're just too busy and we just sort of put them aside. So it's really important to try and encourage kids to try and tell whoever you want to tell as many people as you can and tell them as often as you can to have that message heard. So it's those sorts of things. I think, you know, we also teach kids, you know, there's like five basic sort of, I suppose, areas in the Ditto program that we talk about. So we talk to kids about yes and no feelings. So being able to recognise when they feel safe and when they don't feel safe. So, you know, that sometimes, you know, you might be on a roller coaster and that's a really great, excited feeling and you feel, you know, a bit scared, but it's a good feeling around all of that. Whereas, you know, sometimes if something bad's happening, you have an awful feeling, but it's a no feeling. So trying to teach kids those different things as well. And the private parts issue is a huge one. And in our program, we don't use the anatomically correct names, so we don't talk about penises and vaginas. It's something that we as an organisation took the stance on because when we first started the program back in 2005, we had a few schools sort of saying to us they didn't want the program to come out if we were going to talk about penises and vaginas. They didn't want those language with kids. My personal view and the view of many people is that, look, you know, it's a body part. You know, let's get rid of the shame. Let's teach kids it's just part of your body. But so we don't do that as part of the show. But what we do do is talk to kids about, you know, their chest, between their legs, their bottom. And we also include their mouth as a private part. And a lot of programs don't do that. But their mouth is an incredibly important part to include. A lot of sexual abuse involves the mouth. So, you know, those sorts of messages are sort of really broad messages. They're very easy messages. Language that's quite simple. You're not talking to kids about sexual abuse, about someone, you know, sexually assaulting them or raping them. You're just talking to them about safe feelings.
And about consent. Yeah.
And consent is a huge thing.
From a very young age to be aware that my body, my rules, we can back up those things at home.
100%. Yeah. And I think also with that one, and I always use my grandmother as an example here, and I'm pretty sure she's not a sex offender. But when my nieces and nephews were very young, when my oldest niece was around, she was the first great-granddaughter. My grandmother is this very loving Dutch woman who just hugs and kisses everybody. And Caitlin, and now that she's 24, she's definitely not that, still doesn't like being touched. But she used to always push back whenever my grandmother would try to hug and kiss her. And my family, and I'd sit there watch them going, no, just give her a kiss, give her a hug. And that is, to me, and I've said this to my family many times, the worst thing you could possibly do, because what you're doing is teaching the child, no, you have no rights around your body. If someone wants to kiss or touch you or hug you, they can do that. And that can be a really hard thing, particularly for some cultures and some generations, to be able to sort of say, well, okay, I won't force a child to do that. But we do need to respect children's rights about their bodies.
And has Bravehearts found that your work is increasing?
We are. I mean, when we started this program back in 2004, I think, and I used to go out with the program because we were very small at that stage. I think we had probably around about 14 staff. And so I used to go out, not do the program, but I used to, we had myself as a third person watching the kids who were there doing the show in case there were any negative reactions to the program. We've now got over 70 staff, and we've got the education program across four states. Unfortunately, again, this is not a plug, but it's mostly unfunded, or funded through our organisation through fundraising. Tasmania is the only government, if there's anyone here from Tassie, I'm from Tassie, but is the only government that has funded the program fully. And they've funded it for 3 years and just committed to funding it for another 3 years. The federal government did fund it up in Cairns to stick to going to the Indigenous communities, but we're definitely seeing a huge increase. I think now we've almost reached, or we've just reached, seeing 1 million children through the show. So yeah, and we go back to schools over and over again.
And what about that area of responding to child sexual abuse? Yeah. You have a role in that as well, in the justice system?
Yeah, look, I mean, we talk to parents around all those things that our team was sort of talking about, particularly around, you know, not asking those when, where, why, what questions, using open-ended questions, because, you know, we do understand that as a parent or any adult, that if a child has disclosed to you, your first response is, oh my God, tell me, what did they do? Where did they touch you? Did they do this and do they do that? And that's really, as Martine sort of says, can actually really complicate cases once they go through the court process. We don't support children through the court process. There's another wonderful organisation here in Queensland, PACT, Protect All Children Today, that do that. And we work with them, you know, children that come to Bravehearts for counselling. We will work with PACT to sort of support those kids through the process. The other area, particularly around forensic interviewing and children's voices, is the Family Law Court. And given that Hedy had to not be here today, she'd probably kill me if I didn't mention the Family Law Court. It's her little baby at the moment. But children's voices in the Family Law Court is completely suppressed, you know. And what the courts are doing are listening to the parents. And we know that adults can lie and parents and adults can manipulate. And they do not listen to children. So, you know, that's something that, you know, we're definitely pushing for and looking for and changing legislation to try and get sort of people like Martine, you know, forensic interviewers, to be actually doing those talks, to talking to kids and getting that evidence from them.
So that's an area that really needs to change.
It is. You know, the family law system is horrendous. You know, we put out a report a few years ago called Abby's Project, which is based on a young girl in Western Australia. It was named after a young girl in Western Australia whose parents had been going through the family law court, and her father was allegedly, I have to say, because he's never gone to court, sexually abusing her and one of her friends. And the court sort of ended up giving access for the father, and Abby committed suicide. And there are so many cases where kids are sort of being placed with parents who are risking, not just as fathers either, but it can be mothers as well. And that's another big thing I want to push as well, that, you know, we always talk about sex offenders being males. Women also do harm children, and that can be a really hard thing to get around in your head, because women are seen as maternal, but women, you know, can also sexually offend kids. So when we're giving messages to kids, we've got to be really sort of gender neutral around all of that.
I think we all perhaps summarise just before we go to questions, but John, that makes me think, I think I've heard you speak of how there's really no typical sex offender. There's not one person that we can keep an eye out for in the community and think, right, I've got my eye on him, I'm all sorted. It could be anybody.
Yeah, look, it's not Dennis Ferguson, okay? In fact, Dennis was probably one of the least threats that the community faced, because he's just about, he's blind. So, no, you know, they are police, they are judges, they are doctors, they are lawyers, they pack shells at Woolies. And the stats from our investigation show that and supports kind of to a degree what Carol said, you know, in one operation that we did, 40% of the arrests that we made in a very large operation were married men with kids. And, you know, you can delve into what the reasons behind that are, but Just one thing that they both said that I completely agree with, because we're seeing it now when we do investigations, is believe your child. You know, just believe your child. Don't immediately go. In the early days, you know, when we started getting allegations against the church, you know, they'd wash your mouth out with soap. You know, that priest wouldn't do that to you. And we didn't believe our children then. And it's continuing today.
Really?
Yeah, it's continuing. We arrested a guy last week who, on a grooming case, he was grooming one of our operatives who was pretending to be a kid. When we executed the search warrant and arrested him, we always dig deep. We actually went into the extended family, and two children disclosed sexual abuse by that uncle, and they told their mum. And so they had another 5 years of sexual abuse because when they told their mum, she didn't believe them. So believe your child.
Martine, is there anything you would like to summarise with about that importance of respecting our child's autonomy, I suppose?
I'm still hovering around, you know, in my own area about the concept of belief, because I don't agree with what you're saying, but I also know belief is very fallible and reconstructive, and that minute details are not necessarily, they're often confused, and adults as well. So, in a way, I think when you're saying believe a child is saying take the child seriously. That they, as a valued member of the community, you need to take it seriously and follow through on any report. And I think that is distinct from necessarily believing every single minute detail it said, because no memory is out. It doesn't work like a camera in your head and all of a sudden you pop it open and the same. All memory is reconstructive. And so as interviewers, we've got to do the best job we can to get the best evidence we can to then make decisions based on it. And at the end of the day, you might say, well, my decision based on what the evidence was is that we're not going to go any further. But you've done your best. You've done in that situation. So taking seriously, I think, is important, ravelling around the concept of believing.
And that's something you see too, Karen?
Yeah, definitely. And I just remembered a conversation when I first started at Bravehearts with a police officer at QPS. I don't think it was John. But I remember being told by a police officer that, you know, if a child is telling a story and everything makes sense and it's all logical and it's all in sequence, that's when there's concerns around coaching of children. It's when there is that sort of mixed stories and there's little bits that are missing. That's when you know that there's, you know, more likely that this is actually coming from the child and not from an adult. It is really interesting, and I certainly, you know, I mean, I'm not involved with interviewing children or even counselling with children, but it is sort of a really interesting thing. But the belief of kids for me is absolutely key. And to us, we've often sort of said this, that, you know, if you believe your child, that's the first thing you should do, because even if what the child is telling you isn't the truth, there's some reason why they're saying what they're saying. So it's really important to still listen to what they say to you, and to support them and do whatever you can to sort of help them.
And to get to the bottom of that.
And to get to the bottom of what it is, so most certainly.
So please join me in thanking our panel, John, Martine and Carol.
And that's all for this episode of A Matter of Crime. This podcast was produced for the Griffith Criminology Institute by me, Nance Haxton, with production assistance from Michael Adams. Stay up to date with this Griffith University podcast on SoundCloud. Thanks for joining us. Speak to you again soon.